I just hit record, so the only thing the audience had was headphone jack.
Oh, cool.
We were talking about interfacing with computers and how much that sucks.
I hope it's just the word jack.
Just the word jack?
Yeah.
I can edit it to make it just the word jack.
You do.
Yeah. How are you, Gareth?
I'm fine. How are you, Eden?
I'm good. It's been a while since we've done this chaos configuration of the podcast.
It has. Last was what? Employees?
Employees. And it's funny, we now have a genre for this duo, right? Like a rarefied Scandinavian, slightly weird literature, right?
Yeah. If we're going to Scandinavian, we need to do the entire... I've forgotten the guy's name. The guy who wrote all those huge books about every argument he ever had with his dad.
Who's that? I was thinking of we should do Sion. We should do like the Blue Fox or something from Sion. He's like a Icelandic author.
What's his name? Scandinavian names not going to be great with. Like the greatest Icelandic author is meant to be very good. It's like the Bjork of literature.
Funny you should mention Bjork, because Sion's thing is that he worked with Bjork, and by the way, he also helped Robert Eggers with The Northman. He's an interesting guy. But we're not here to talk about Sion.
No.
We're here to talk about Sven. Specifically Sven Holm. I will admit that I was completely ignorant of this guy's name, but apparently he's like Ishiguro of Denmark, basically.
I had the Faber edition of this book, which is really nicely designed. It's got a cactus on it for some reason. And also put out Kay Dick, who me and Langdon did an episode about.
Yep.
They're just getting really knocking it out of the park on unknown authors, well, unknown at least in the English speaking world, who are just you kind of need to know. Is people like Emmerich Pressburger, Wilson Harris, Emily Holmes Coleman. I have no idea who these people are, but they're apparently brilliant.
I have the FSG Originals edition. It has a huge hotel bell, is like a mushroom cloud on the cover. And it has a foreword by Jeff Vandermeer.
Mm-hmm. I got that too.
Yeah, so this continues my tradition of reading everything that Vandermeer recommends and is yet to proven me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about Termush, to be clear. Sven Holm's 1967 novel that was translated to English quite late. I think posthumously even, which is very interesting. Oh no, the English translation was published in 1969. But it was out of print for a long time until these new reprints came along. And I'm really glad they did, because I thoroughly enjoyed the novel. I mean, maybe enjoyed is the wrong word. It's a very punishing
novel. I enjoyed
it,
I think.
Yeah. So let's do the storyline, which is really not the point with this book. So this was written in 67, right? So the post-apocalypse du jour was atomic apocalypse. And that's what happens even before the book begins, right? We don't see the bombing or whatever. But a bunch of well-to-do people have gathered in a hotel called Termush that they paid for in advance to kind of serve this purpose, right? To save them in case of society collapsing. And that's it. It's the story of the first few weeks after the nuclear apocalypse. And it almost entirely is centered inside the hotel, and for sure around the hotel. As we follow the narrator, who is one of the residents of the hotel. We never learn his name, right? It's always first person, and no one calls him.
We don't even know if it's a he. It's never actually...
Fair enough.
It's implied he's attracted to a woman, but
fair enough.
But
So there's a lot to talk about with this novel. To be clear, this is one of your... Nothing really happens.
It is entirely vibes based. To the last quarter, a plot of kind of sorts develops. There are antagonists.
Yeah,
as in people with guns.
And I think that's, you could focus on that. And I think the book does have something to say with its plot, right? Which is basically the center cannot hold, right? It's impossible to be isolated and survive the post-apocalypse just as a group of people. The outside world will always find you, right? The plot at the last quarter of the book, as Gav said, is outsiders basically not really liking the idea of this heavily stockpiled and safe hotel being kept just for people who paid for it before the world collapsed, and they slowly learn about it and basically invade it and drive out the rich people there, which is very cool and nice. It ends with all the rich people. I mean, you don't see them dying, but it's hinted that they die in the middle of the ocean. Mm-hmm. And that's the plot. But the book has a lot more to say than that, which is where the vibes come in. I think for me, what was the most unique was the focus on architecture and how architecture can communicate nefarious and oppressive sensations, right? Like the narrator lingers on the arrangement of the hotel and his room. It's hinted that management is like this amorphous group of people that control the hotel. They arranged his personal room in a certain way to like oppress him and like constantly draw him into this introspection. So management is always trying to like manage the guest's mental state, right? Like one of the things that they're concerned with.
Ineffectively, they're very bad at it.
Yeah, they're quite bad at it. But that's what they're trying to do, right? Like they don't want panic to set, or not even panic, but also depression is like a specter that's haunting everyone there. Again, the world is destroyed, right? And they do that in all sorts of ways. And one of the most interesting ones is for this architecture that is... did someone knock at your door?
Yes, sorry. It's
all good. Sorry. It was just very ominous as I was speaking about like... architectural space controlling him. So like the mirror is very much centered in his room, and all of the like what's what I'm looking for, like the fixings on the walls, the paintings and the wallpaper, they all like draw him towards the mirror. And Holm does a really good job. Like this book is not horror, but it's also very creepy. Right? Like this creeping sensation of being looked at, of being surveilled, of being managed without you noticing. I don't know, I really like that aspect of it, and how Telmush itself, the hotel, is so oppressive and like a character in the book almost.
I kind of feel like I could draw a diagram of Telmush, and I could kind of walk through it, and kind of I can it is very visual, very like has a really strong sense of space. The gardens as well.
I was gonna say with the statues.
Yeah, and the radiation detectors, because the other thing apart from the oppressive nature of the space itself is the radiation, because it's invisible, it can kill you. Plenty of people get irradiated in this, and there may or may not be radiation at any point. It's like the terrifying thing about radiation. You can just at any point walk in the wrong place and then you're dead.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily feel that you're dead, right? It's not like something hits you in the head. It can take weeks. And one clever thing that Holm does here is he constantly undermines the alert system, right? Like at some point, so in the beginning of the book, there are these alarms that send all the guests into the basement where there's like a bomb shelter. But at some point, the narrator asks, well, how do we know if there's any correlation between them hitting the alarm and actual radiation levels? Right? Like they could just hit the alarm. We can't see the gauges. We can't see the actual numbers. That's all reserved for management. And that's actually one of the... Okay, so reading it today, as much as you'd like to try, you can't really divorce it from the only experience that we have that's anywhere like this, which is COVID. Right, and kind of the isolation that COVID brought upon us slash is bringing on those of us who still, you know, recognize the fact that it exists. And it's kind of the same. You know, I remember when the first waves were rolling out and all the governments were standing up these data apparatus to report on it. And I was like, what does this mean? What does this mean about levels of COVID where I am. It's just meaningless, right? Like plus 500 people were diagnosed with COVID in the state of, in Israel, right, where I was at. Okay, but that is zero indication to the risk that is posed to me. First of all, because they under-test and under-count. And second of all, there's that like 14-day lag. So there's a disconnect between the surveillance apparatus and its alarming system and reality.
Hmm. And through all of COVID, that gap between what we were told and what we know, obviously it brought about like all the conspiracy stuff, but just in everyone's life, like my life and yours probably, things like washing your groceries or is it even airborne? If I go in, if I like nominated myself to be the household, like the scout to go out into the wasteland and retrieve stuff from the shop around the corner.
Yeah.
And like, I didn't know if I was going to come back and kill my entire family for about a few weeks there.
Yeah.
Because we just didn't know. And we still don't know. We don't know so much about this disease that's like defined the last half decade almost.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, it's interesting to think about the moving anxiety of society, right? Like no one today thinks about atomic war, but to be clear, that threat has never been removed.
Hmm. Right? Yeah, the atomic clock is still at like 11:59. It's just kind of stuck there. I think don't feel like putting it back. Realistically, I don't think any nuclear wars are on the horizon anytime soon.
But what I'm saying is like all of the mechanical conditions for nuclear war still exist, right? Like the weapons are all still there. The capacity for that war is still there. But it's a social thing, right? None of us have had classes in school teaching us to duck and roll, and we weren't told about the flash, and you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki are like forgotten names in many ways. Not to mention like Nolan's part in completely laundering the image. Well, not laundering, to be fair, because the movie is critical of Oppenheimer, but disappearing the Japanese victims of the atomic bomb. But then you read something like this, and of course, while I was reading it, I was also thinking about Aniara, right? Because it's Scandinavian, because it's about nuclear post-apocalypse, because it's about characters being stuck in a confined space, albeit the one in Aniara is a bit more troubling. I was constantly drawing comparisons between the two. And I think it's interesting that in many ways, Termush got under my skin more than Aniara, right? Even though the threat is a threat that I no longer fear, I feel like it did a better job. Aniara does some things better, but this did a better job at like making me feel the apprehension and the anxiety of radiation, which is similar to the anxiety from infection that you describe.
The thing that came up for me a lot with this was Douglas Rushkoff. Do you know him?
Yeah.
You probably have read his article. I think it was initially on his Substack, but then it kind of went a bit viral and spread around the world. And I think I've got a version of it here from The Guardian. There's also Business Insider, Financial Times. About how he was as a futurist, which is a total non-job,
yeah.
But respect to him anyway. He was taken out to an island, I think it was Hawaii or something, and met with a bunch of billionaires in Patagonia fleeces, and four of them sat him down in a room, and he thought he was going to a conference, but he was actually just talking to these four guys. They said, okay, after shit hits the fan, however that's going to happen, we're going to be in our bunkers and we're going to have our armed guards with us. But how do we keep control of our guards? Because our guards have to protect us from the outside world. And we can't do it ourselves, just us and our families. We need to rely on other people. We need like a class system in here and to be served in the way we've become used to being served our entire lives.
Yeah.
They had ideas like, you know, put on battle royale style explosive collars, keeping all the food under lock and key. This is all their ideas, not Douglas Rushkoff. Douglas Rushkoff said okay, treat them nicely, be as egalitarian with them as you possibly can, and they'll, and you know, pitch in and do some work, and then you'll all become like a big commune, and you can and that's the best way to survive. And that is like, there is like a kind of leftist prepper movement, including Margaret Kiljoy, who's been on the show a few times. She has a really good podcast about leftist prepping, as an aside. But that, I remember that article, and he wrote a book about it, Survival of the Richest. That article came up a lot because the central problem is the same, which is how does the narrator survive when his survival is dependent on customer service of like a hotel keeping him alive, when they really don't have much much reason to do so. Like the rich people are dead weight. They have nothing to offer. The only thing,
almost, should they just like have brandy and laze about and play cards, right? That's all they're capable of doing.
Well, like the scouts are going out into the wasteland, getting irradiated, getting in gunfights with super mutants, I assume. I can only assume this is a Fallout
universe. Is in the Fallout universe, yeah.
Yeah. We were actually being paid by Amazon Prime to promote the new series. It looks like shit.
It looks so bad. I mean, Fallout has been bad for a while now, which is a shame.
It has.
But it's
Where was I? They're entirely dependent on this parasitic... They're parasites on this class of people who actually do things. It could be a very unsubtle metaphor for the workers and the workers and parasites, you know?
Yeah.
There is literally no reason why these guys have to work all day for people who just drink brandy and fuck each other. And yet they seem to be doing that, even though they're not getting paid. They're not getting anything out of this arrangement.
Yeah, it's kind of like they're locked into the social order, right? Which is kind of like what we tell the billionaires, like, in a post-apocalypse, you should just maintain all of the control mechanisms that you're maintaining today. There is no reason for your guards to protect you today either. There is a bit more of a reason than after the post-apocalypse, but not a very good one. The reason they do it is because they're shackled into class politics that you use to control the rest of us, right? So just like maintain those mechanisms, which include you not putting explosive collars around the necks of people and manipulating them in more subtle ways. That also happens in Telmush, right? Like the scouting party or the people who actually do things are manipulated by management by the crudest methods of what's called hydraulic tyranny, right? They basically control their food and their water supply.
Yeah, which is another thing the billionaires suggest to Rushkoff, that they would keep the food under lock and key and everyone else would have to serve them. It would the first time they ever went to sleep, that would end.
That would end, yeah. And I think Telmush doesn't like... Telmush is more focused on like exploring the psyche of the parasites, which is really interesting. And you mentioned sex and the relationship of the narrator with Mary, his love interest, is so fucking bizarre that I still don't know what to make of it. Like, super dark. Like, he imagines her as dead multiple times when the light is off. At some point, I thought he was doing a Fight Club. This predates Fight Club, right? But no one talks to Mary. No one interacts with Mary for a lot of the book. And then when there's the scene where he opens the room, everything is innuendo, right? Like, he never says they fucked, right? It's always like, she came to my room after dinner, right? Or I retire to Mary's. It's obvious that they're fucking, right? But at some point, he opens the door and he sees her like splayed on the bed. And he thinks she's dead. Like, he says she's a corpse. And I was like, oh, he was doing Fight Club. Like, she died at the first week and this guy's imagining her. But then he turns on the light and Mary's behind him in this really creepy way. There's another point where he's like looking in the mirror and suddenly she's looking at him from within the mirror. Like, she's sitting behind him and staring at him. She is like full on weird. Others are like self-medicating with alcohol, right? They're just getting wasted all the time. And yet more like there's the obvious like fascist wing inside of the parasites. What is he called? The guy who rallies him. He has like a funny name for him.
The guy's like a doctor of some kind.
Oh, the doctor is also an interesting character that like kind of collaborates with the narrator. But there's this one guy that votes on not sharing supplies with the
right.
survivors. Yeah. And he gives him a name, like chairman or something like that. Mm. And that's how he's known as. And that's like the fascist wing of the parasites, right? Most of the rich people are like, just, I don't want to think about the dirty people who survived outside of the hotel. Mm. Yeah. I don't care if you give them food, but just like, don't do it here. And that's what management does as well. They're like, we're going to help these people. Because we're not fucking monsters like you are. But we're going to put them in the basement. Right? Yeah. Like, we're not... You don't need to think about them. And that's not enough, by the way, for the fascists. The fascists go, that's not good enough. They are not allowed to eat our food.
Hmm.
Like, the stuff that we paid for, we will not share with them. We don't mind if they eat, but we also don't want to think about where they might get food, right? I mean, it shouldn't be us. And also, they're stupid, like the rich people.
Hmm.
They're very stupid because management tells them, yes, sure, we won't give them any of your food, but what other food is there? And it works. Like, the rich people are like, okay, cool.
The management ultimately are much closer to the refugees than they are to the rich people.
Yeah.
They're, And there's that woman who... she's asked for a urine sample and she just refuses to give it and has a breakdown almost because she almost like can't believe that she would her body would fail on her.
Yeah.
Like she's like, who's that? That guy who is always, always going viral because he takes like 500 supplements a day, including estrogen. That fella, you know, the guy.
Liver King?
Oh, no, he's awful, too.
Oh, I know. The CEO who's like, wants to stay young forever.
That kind of guy.
Who has
clearly hired a PR firm just to get his name out there because he is in the news every single day. This guy who can't imagine not being...
human.
Yeah, not having like a human body that grows old, dies, that isn't as good as it was when he was 20. And he still he's like 45. He looks like a 45-year-old. So
that's funny.
More feminine because he takes estrogen.
Yeah. It's funny you bring him up because I wanted to bring up Epstein in the discussion of Termush. And I wasn't sure how I was going to get there. And this is a really nice segue because one of the things that people forget about Epstein is that he really liked science fiction. To the extent that he paid for crazy science labs at MIT and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Still
there. That lab still exists. Whose job was to like find, you know, superfoods for space exploration. And if you think it has nothing to do with his sexual perversions, you're wrong. Because he was seeing himself as populating a new humanity with his DNA.
Mm.
Of course, like all of the science fiction authors that he might have read, which is probably Frank Herbert and Asimov and all those guys,
this is an aside. The Elon Musk, Jeffrey Epstein, these people who are like big billionaire sci-fi fans. They're sci-fi fans in the way that like someone who likes Imagine Dragons is a rock music fan.
Yeah.
They don't fuck with the more difficult stuff. Even the like popular difficult stuff like Philip K. Dick or someone.
Drawing a sketch on the dog.
Strictly co-worker science fiction. But anyway, Epstein was like that as well.
Yeah. I was going to say that it's like the meme of that girl who's like sketching around a dog, like around a toy, and in the end looks nothing like the dog. It's like a fucked up version of it. That's how they understand Dune. Mm. I'd like imagine reading Dune and going, race science is actually good.
I must be the God Emperor in Epstein's case.
Exactly.
Another aside. Okay, 40K fan theory. The Emperor's actually Jeffrey Epstein.
That was
one of his many incarnations on Earth. Was
many forms.
Jeffrey Epstein.
That makes total sense. I was going to say, you know, this is part of that. When you're a billionaire and you have so much money and so much power, and you're intrinsically tied ideologically to the idea that you've earned it, right? You cannot accept the idea that you just got lucky. If you're that powerful, it must mean you're a bit more than human, right? Mm-hmm. If you have so much power and you earn that power, like if you've climbed the ladder of meritocracy so high that you're a billionaire, then you must be superhuman. And if you're superhuman, then it's in the humanity's vested interest that your genes continue to populate existence and the human kind. But, and here's how it ties back to Termish, you can't let those genes and your power be polluted by the general demographic of humanity, right? Like, they know not what they do. They're not bad people. They're just like ignorant sheep that need to be tended by you, and therefore you have to remove yourself. Now, Epstein is like a very extreme example of that removal, but every single billionaire does that. You know what did a really good job of showing that? Ex Machina. Mm-hmm. Alex Garland's Ex Machina, with that like mansion that Oscar Isaac's character lives in. This is what billionaires do. They create these hidey holes, some of them for the apocalypse, some of them just because they want to be removed from humanity, because it is intrinsically tied to this God Emperor, I am the chosen one, I am better than the rest of you, I have to keep myself pure. But now that I think about it, Ex Machina also shows Oscar Isaac like working out all the time. Mm. It's the same kind
green of juice cleanses and so on.
Exactly.
Mark Zuckerberg has recently built a really, really big bunker complex in Hawaii. Like, yeah. Not just talking like a little bunker you could like hide in for a few weeks, but talking like a underground city kind of thing. There's going to be like hundreds of people down there with him.
Yeah. And again, he needs those people so he can control someone. And, you know, you can't be the God Emperor if no one worships you.
Hmm.
Right. So Termush has a different take on all of this. I mean, a similar one, but a different one. And again, maybe because it's in the 60s, it really focuses on the fact that at no point in the book, anyone except the narrator, and even the narrator not that much, thinks of joining forces with the other humans who survived.
Hmm.
Right? Yeah. I'm not saying let them in as dependents and feed them and whatever. You could make the case then that's like, it's not sustainable and there's not enough food for everyone and you have to make tough choices, yada, yada, yada. But like, okay, why are we sending a scouting party if people are already live out there? They're alive, right? We can talk to them and ask them if there's like non-contaminated areas. We could give them food so they go scouting for us. We could do so many things that require cooperation. We could not pay Termush to begin with. Right, like we could build the project to sustain more people instead of just the 40 rich people, right? But it's not an option, because these rich people see themselves as removed from society, right? They don't want to be a part of society. Mm-hmm. And Termush really also brings that home with the basements, right? The shelters that these rich people go into. Once they're there, like once they go into this, these are some of the weirdest scenes in the book, because these people like collapse onto themselves from being inside of these shelters. It has like a soporific effect on them, right? They start to drift into sleep and lose connection to reality and so on. And this is Holmes' like criticism of this isolationist reflex, right? There's only so much you can isolate before you start to shut yourself down, right? So I think it has like a very clever input on this kind of how this isolation works, what it hopes to achieve, what are its pitfalls. And again, it was written in 67, where I think it was prescient for like how the ruling class will continue to divorce itself from the people that they rule and like retreat deeper and deeper into the shelters.
Hmm, yeah, but it reminds me of two different things. So two tangents in one here. The first is, have you ever heard the term dime square?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. it is an entirely unfortunate thing. So as listening to friend of the show and former guest, J.G. Michael's podcast, Parallax View, and yeah. It had a interview with the guy who coined the term dime square and wrote a play about it. And the way that whole thing came about, where rich kind of artsy leftist New Yorkers.
Nepo babies, right? they're on their most, baby.
Yeah, a lot of them. Also, a lot of crypto people who lived in New York.
Yeah.
Like, people who hung out at, like, Verso and wrote for Jacobin and so on. People who, you know, who in another life would probably be friends of the show. How they, like, flipped overnight into fascism. Like, and he called it openly exterminationist fascism.
Yeah.
How they flipped was lockdowns during New York. These were like super social people who went out, partied all the time, always around other people. And then when they're having to be inside for weeks at a time, it just destroyed them. You know, yeah. They had their entire sense of self was bound up in like the party scene. And when they didn't have it, the only people who were still having parties were these like weird crypto fascist Mencius Molebug types who were like self-consciously rejecting the whole idea of there could be COVID, people can get sick because the whole magical voluntarist thing that you have when you're right wing.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that seems to be like it's kind of anticipated a bit by Termush. They're trying to maintain this pre-apocalyptic lifestyle of going to a fancy hotel, getting waited on, partying, drinking brandy, fucking. And it's simply not possible given the material conditions around them.
Yeah. And the inability to handle the fact that it's not possible comes out in this fascist, exterminationist politics, right? Instead of facing the fact that they need to change, they will change the world in the most brutal way that they can think of.
Mm, yeah. You could possibly tie that into just fascism in general. I mean,
yeah.
It kind of arose during things like the Spanish flu and post-World War One, when there's loads of disabled people everywhere and society has to help them. And yet my business is suffering, and yet we're giving all this money to someone who got their legs blown off in the trenches. Or people who are still sick have got like long Spanish flu, as we'd call it nowadays. And then you can't just say, okay, we need something a bit better to solve these problems. We need to eliminate all these people.
Yeah.
The second thing that I'm reminded of by Termush is a fire in an Argentinian supermarket in 2004.
Okay.
Bear with me here.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. So there's this chain of supermarkets called the Eucalabalanos supermarkets in Argentina. They're like the Tesco or the Kmart or I don't know.
Yeah.
Of Argentina.
The Carrefour.
The what? What?
Carrefour. That's the French supermarket.
Oh, okay. Ooh la la. Classy. Yeah.
Yeah.
En français. So, yeah. And there was a very small gas fire in 2004, and it was like a minor thing. It shouldn't have been. No one should have died. No one should have even got hurt. Because it was a very small fire, and everyone could have just got out the store. Everything would be fine. Some minor property damage. That'd be it. Unfortunately, what happened was the sons of the owner of the supermarket and the management of the supermarket locked all the doors of the supermarket.
What the
every
fuck?
Single one. And 327 people died.
Holy shit.
Yeah, this is like, if you're Argentinian, you know about this. It's like their 9/11. And
holy
it's,
shit. That's crazy.
And this is like burnt alive dying. It's, and
yeah.
You know, it's... Once the fire like really got out of hand, it just 327 died, 300 injured, and it was caused by like a faulty barbecue chimney.
Jeez.
And this has been like studied as an example of what psychologists call elite panic,
mm-hmm.
which is the tendency of the elites to believe that when there's a problem, that ordinary people are going to react in the worst way. As in, they believe that all the ordinary poor people who are inside the supermarket were going to start looting the shelves and emptying them instead of just coming out the door. Or they wouldn't pay for their goods. And so instead, they locked the whole thing and like slaughtered 300 people pretty much right in front of them. And this has been seen in sociologists have studied this in like loads of like disasters, things like Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
Like people imagined that as soon as the hurricane hit, all the mostly racialized people in New Orleans were going to start looting. And there literally was no looting. Like there's none at all.
But there were people like hunting people in the streets.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. There were like gangs of rednecks in the back of turning their F-150s into technicals to kind of hunt down black people. Yeah. There was, what's his name? Chris Kyle, American sniper guy.
Yeah. Apparently, he just hunted people.
Yeah. He was just like, allegedly. Allegedly. It's never been corroborated if he actually killed people. Apparently he was on top of the Superdome or the sports being just like clinking every human he saw in case they were looters.
Yeah.
He also claimed to have shot some carjackers, and that apparently never happened. He was like a weird fantasist, in addition to being like,
I think
a horrible mass slaughterer.
Yeah, I think Tuanon did like a whole thing on him, and also on Hurricane Katrina. Like one day, I think all that shit will be declassified, and we will find out it was much worse than what we thought.
Oh yeah,
like I dread the day that shit is declassified because. I think like straight up, like people were hunted there for sport.
Mm.
Which is absolutely insane.
Yeah, there's like interviews with people who are like, you know, this the race war is happening, fellas. Let's get into our trucks and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but, I think. Go on.
But you know, it's and even as far as back as like big earthquakes in San Francisco, pretty much leveled the whole city. Again, the elites of the city were like, okay, deploy the police and National Guard, make sure there's no looting, order must be maintained and all that. And it was like people were just like helping each other and setting up soup kitchens. And 9 times out of 10, these soup kitchens would get like trashed by the police because they somehow believed that would be keeping order.
And, because that's what the police does, right? Like when you have a hammer, everything is a nail.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and
it's interesting, like, you know, because the mirror idea of elite panic is disaster communism, right? Well, when a disaster strikes, suddenly everybody's a communist. Mm. You know, unfortunately, like one of the last manifestations of that I got to see was Israel. Whenever there's a war, some of my coworkers. Who are staunch capitalists. I know this because I've argued with them before about capitalism. Suddenly, like one of them was sharing this news story about someone who was hiking up apartment prices for people who were coming back from reserve duty. Right? Like they had gone to the war. Again, putting aside, you know, if people need a reminder, like Israel is genocidal, I'm anti-Zionist, free Palestine. I believe in all those things. Putting that aside, like, these people were coming back from reserve duty, and this person was like saying, "Cool, I know you need a place to crash, and you have to have it. So now your rent is 500% higher, right?" Mm. And she was sharing this this article, appalled. And I was like, "You should be this appalled whenever anybody raises any rent anywhere, right?" Yeah. Like this is
that's what
landlords
happened
to
my electricity and groceries over the last couple of years.
Exactly, like that's how the system works. Like you need a place to sleep, you don't have a choice, therefore I can take whatever rent that the market will let me, regardless of how bad off you are or what situation you are in your life, right? You should be this shocked always, but you only do this when a disaster hits, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the flip side of everything you said. You know, San Francisco, there's an earthquake, people start to help each other without asking for payment. Right? Mm. They just help each other because they can, and these people need help, which is the organizing principle behind communism, right? from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. That's exactly what that means. So in Telmush, though, there isn't a flip side, right? There's no mirror image to the rich people. I mean, the people on the outside are, but we never
the raiders,
see them.
I guess for the raiders, all we know, there are they're the leftist commune that we keep hearing about on Twitter.
What will your role be in the leftist commune?
Raider, super mutant.
Raider, I'll be the guy who's shooting all the rich people. I think it's interesting though that, like, well, of course he makes the obvious point that the raiders are many and the rich people inside of Termish are few, which already hints towards their like larger ability to cooperate, right? Like one of the last scenes is they see fires all around the hotel, right? Which is the fires of the people who are about to attack them. But there is no counterpoint because, again, the book is focusing on what the fuck is wrong with these people. Like, that's the question of Thomas. Like, what is wrong with rich people?
They're not even that rich, are they?
They're not billionaires
or anything. They're
not billionaires.
Like, one of them's a doctor, which is wealthy, but it's not
exactly
billionaires.
The upper middle class. Mm. And that's exactly what I was going to say when you said about, like, you know, the people in Times Square and so on, like falling apart once their social mores were no longer, you know, maintainable. There's this idea that I've been trying to get across to people. That it's not my idea, right? But I think it's underplayed in our society for obvious reasons. The most violent people in the modern history are not the fanatical ideologues. Those are the people who start the movement or light the fire. But the people who enable the most mass violence is the complacent middle class. The violence of the Friday night dinner, right? With the heteronormative family core, with the 2.5 kids and a dog in a big house with a car in the driveway. That is the violence that enables empire, genocide, extractivism. Okay, because the radicals, they are like a flash fire, right? They burn up all the oxygen around them. They run through support very, very quickly, right? The guy who says you should literally round up all the brown people and shoot them in the head. Okay, that guy doesn't get very far in a vacuum. He burns very, very brightly. He might do some really fucked up shit, right? He might actually go out and kill people, but then that's it, right? Like a mass shooter, like, for example. Like a white supremacist American which are predominantly the mass shooters that exist, right? That goes out and kills Jewish people or brown people or whatever, right? They kill 10, 20, in most horrific cases more, which is really bad and awful, don't get me wrong, but it's not anywhere close to the Iraq war, right? And how many people died there. The Iraq war doesn't get done with Dylan Roofs. That's one of the notorious mass shooters, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't get done with those people. It gets done with people like us who cling to good old American values and the family unit and all that shit. That's how violence gets done. And you know who said it most brilliantly, I think? Douglas Adams. So in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, there's the planet Cricket, where they lived in a gas cloud, so they didn't see any stars, right? And they didn't know there was other life in the universe except for them. Not even the possibility of other life. It was a complete, like, what does Wittgenstein call it? Frame belief, right? Belief that you can't understand the world without. And then suddenly a ship crashes on their planet. And they retro engineer the ship to get it to work. And this guy, he's a whimsical middle-class guy who found the spaceship because he was walking back from his day working in the field with, you know, like a corn stem in his lips, whistling a tune. And he rides the spaceship outside and he sees all these stars and the magnificence of the universe. And he says, okay, this all has to go, right? We have to annihilate all of this because it is making our lives really small, and now we understand how meaningless we are, so we will wage intergalactic war and try to destroy everybody else. That's how it happens, okay? And Gareth, you're from the home of that, right? Like, that's how the British Empire was maintained.
Oh, yeah, big time.
The violence of good old British values, right? And God save the Queen and all that stuff. That's how it happened.
Yeah, primary upper middle class, public school boys, and could go on a whole thing about how public school, public school in the UK means private school.
Private school is
weird. Yeah, it's weird. But people who pay to go to school and board there, and how violence and particularly sexual violence, it plays into these people becoming these like utterly soulless agents of empire who can do things like say, oh, we need to divert grains from India to the UK because people here are getting a bit antsy without food, and that ends up killing 4 million people in India.
Or in Ireland.
I mean, that was slightly before this system got really put into place.
But I think, like, you know, you could go back, you know, again, this is not a history podcast, but like, so I have 70% of an MA in history, and I wrote the thesis that I never finished, but that I wrote was on the Leveller revolution in the English Civil Wars. Yeah. And specifically how it worked in London and the use of London spaces like a political arena and so on. Mm-hmm. But because I studied that period, I had the displeasure of learning about Cromwell.
Yeah. And still are £20 notes.
For some reason, genocidal
monster in every way. Even when he was a kid, him and his friends would go around and like rape women.
Yeah, like, but that's
an absolute monster.
But that's the same instinct, right? It's the same kind of, because Cromwell became, even though he was a regicide, right? Even though he was, which to be clear is good, right? all the kings should be dead, all of them, but. In his case, it was a time when it was not okay to be a regicide. He still became a figure of British stiff upper lipness, proper British man, right? He is Hitler. He's 17th century Hitler. That's what Cromwell is. So again, it's from the center of the political map, from the manners, from the consensus, that the worst kind of violence is created. By the way, this is all Michel Foucault, right? Like, we didn't invent any of this.
I'm also reminded of a few months, weeks back, when we had Matt McManus on talking about the kind of people who invented modern conservative thought.
Yeah.
Your Burkes, De Maistres. These were not the French aristocracy getting their heads cut off. These were like middle management of the aristocracy.
Yeah.
And they were the most fanatical about it. I mean, they were the people who wrote entire books basically saying like, yeah, I know Louis XVI isn't a god king, but we need to make sure everyone in the world believes that, despite the fact it's completely ludicrous.
Yeah,
because things like reason and rationality are satanic. It's like utterly bizarre beliefs.
I mean, we keep going into history, right? But like, the people that's people forget about the French Revolution, like the counter revolution that finally succeeded, the Thermidorian reaction, was not all these arch noble houses. All those guys ran away.
Like, yeah, the first minute, they got money.
They got money. They just emigrated. They just left. And the people who stayed and like sowed the seeds of rebellion that eventually became the Thermidorian reaction were middle management nobility. Those guys are the worst possible. And to bring it back to the book, like, he really shows how guys in Termush, all the guys, all the people that are in loafers and dress pants, and they like a bit of brandy, not a lot of brandy, right? Just after dinner, and then maybe another glass, and then you start like inappropriately touching people and being racist and so on. Those are the people who say things like, leave all the irradiated people outside the hotel to die painfully while we have pain medication, right? Those are the people who do that, and I think it does it brilliantly by being understated. It's a very understated book, right? And it kind of tries to counter their understated violence with this subtle criticism. There's one more point that I wanted to make, which I really, really liked. There's this part, again, going back to the alarm system, where the narrator talks about this idea that I also, first I suffered from it, and then I tried to start to think about it and conceptualize it, that the alarm, like, we would rather have the alarm as a binary indicator of danger, mm-hmm. That tells us either it's safe or it's not safe. Because we would rather deal with that than with the spectrum of danger, which is actually reality. And this ties us back to COVID as well, right? Like this idea of either I get infected or I don't. Mm. Either I have long COVID or I don't. Whereas the reality is like, how do you get infected? How much? How much does it affect you? Long COVID is a name for a range of phenomenon, right? A range of possible interactions between the virus and your body. Now we're finding out, I mean, virologists knew this, just the public didn't, that there's long everything, right? There's long flu. There's long everything. That's how viruses work, right? They never really fade away entirely in all people. But we are drawn to this idea of, I remember in the beginning of COVID, the question was, does it kill you or not? Like, how deadly is it? And I was always like, guys, you know that there are like other really, really, really bad things that can happen to you that don't involve death?
Especially like, when you're in like a massively interconnected society where everything, like things that are happening in China will end up affecting you in the UK. I mean, it's obviously not as bad as death. Like, how much our finances have been affected and how much politics has changed, how much individuals have radicalized.
Exactly. And the conversation, the early conversation, and it still revolves around that. Oh, it's not, it won't kill you. Like, you're healthy, right? You're young. You don't have to worry about it. Stop wearing masks. Stop not going to events and so on. Because it's fine, because you won't die. Like, that is very easy. I mean, death is very scary, but it also either happens or it doesn't. And then as long as it doesn't, you can lie to yourself and say that you're safe. That's what the characters in Telemush do, right? As long as the alarm is not going off, they're safe. But as you said, radiation can be anywhere. There's also radiation over time. Sure, the radiation is not triggering the alarm, but over a year, we're going to die anyway because we're being irradiated all the time. And it really, that was a really salient point. I think it was the paragraph that most arrested me in the entire book, of like calling out that kind of binary idea of safety versus danger, whereas the world is much more complex in the things that it can inflict on us. But we're so afraid of it that we would rather hide in the idea of either it's on or it's off.
There's this really kind of beautiful passage about where the narrator imagines what could be happening outside of, in where this world has been bathed in radiation and changed. Like, is our trees becoming crystalline? Is the air changing to something else? Is what, just what could be happening? Which is probably why Jeff Vandermeer likes this so much. It sounded basically like he's talking about the zone at that
point. In general, radiation is very, you know, we could cite Langdon is not here, but we could cite Deleuze, right? Like mutation, the idea of the body that it mutates in a way, it becomes deterritorialized, right? Like the clear boundaries of the biological map get rubbed aside by radiation. Which is basically what happens in the zone in area X, right? Like this alien entity, spoilers for Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation. This alien entity is like warping the clear boundaries between things. But it's very interesting that, you know, it's interesting that we went to COVID, where the other thing that we could equate like Termish's panic to is climate change, right? All pervasive. Has no boundaries, respects no boundaries, changes everything that is normal. And
are you gonna say hyper object at some point? Because you have to drink a shot every time you say hyper object.
Yeah, I was not gonna say hyper object. I'm trying to phase that word out of my out of my vocabulary. I still think that it's useful, but it's so overused that I try to steer away from it. And it's, you know what's funny? Maybe at the outset here, like to summarize all of this. This book has 105 pages.
It is very tiny.
It's very tiny, and this is 105 very short pages, right? This is not like dense.
Oh yeah, chapters like 2-3 pages long, aren't they?
Yeah, there's some chapters are like one page. It's very interesting. but it has so much inside of it, right? It has so much psyche and so much like very subtle politics. It's quite interesting. Too bad. Like I think everything else that Holm wrote was either dramas, like I think he did theater, and then they're all fiction, but they're not like this isn't science fiction necessarily, but they're not in our realm of usual reading because
it's kind of like social realist, not kind of social democratic social realism.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, be nice to each other, folks.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing as maybe a criticism of his politics, right? It's very Danish. Right? It's very Nordic model politics, right? Let's just all take care of each other just a bit more.
Yeah.
Right? Wouldn't that be nice?
But should we cap off with some musical
yes, please.
Delights for people?
Yes, please.
Let me see. Oh, what was I going to play here? There is a new song by Botanist, but there's a new song by Botanist like every other week.
Always, yeah. I mean, it's very good, and I'm very excited for the album. It sounds really good. I have a few things that I could play if you're blanking.
Yeah, go for it. I didn't have anything in my up my sleeves. Cool.
So I'm going to do a Death Sentence classic, and we're going to follow up on a very like understated episode with very non-understated music. Because Savage Oath have a new album out,
nice,
called Divine Battle. And I got an interesting comment on Twitter. I shared Blood for the King, which is also the track that I'm going to play. And someone commented, I wish more of the tracks on this album sounded like this and weren't like more fast Euro style of power metal. And I was like, that's not true. That's not a true analysis of like how the geolocation differences between power metal. So there's US power metal and there's European power metal. And it is true that European power metal, that's the old school power metal for anyone listening. That's your Blind Guardian, Avantasia, all of these bands, Ed Guy, all of these bands that tend to be cheesier. And yeah, they do tend to be faster, like more gallopy and so on. Whereas US power metal is more muscular power metal, right? It's more forward, more influenced by heavy metal. But then, these diagrams completely break down if you start to look at the actual bands that have been making these styles for the last few years. It might have been true in the 80s, but even then, like, you have bands like the Lord Weird Slaufeg, which don't fit into any of these definitions. You have
Manila Road.
Yeah, kind of Manila Road.
Always getting cited as like an influence by this kind of new generation of power metal.
Exactly. And you have Savatage, right? You have these bands that are in the US and are making fast power metal, or in Europe and making very epic, slow, doom-tinged power metal. And then, yeah, you do have bands like Kirith Ungol and so on.
Kirith Ungol
are, yeah, phenomenal. Making that more kind of like muscular power metal, which is all to say, to bring it back to Savage Oath, who can do both. And it's a good thing that they do both, because both those forms of power metal are cool. They just, what? Okay, so one of them is Elric and one of them is Conan. Okay, so the Euro power metal is Elric and the US power metal is Conan. Conan and Elric are both cool. You don't like, let's not do like who would win, Goku or Batman, right? Like who would win, Elric or Conan? No, they would join forces to kill the evil whatever. So I don't know, think about that as you listen to Blood for the King, and do check out Divine Battle by Savage Oath, because it is one of the best like heavy power metal albums of the last few years, which is, by the way, that's saying something, because there have been a lot of really good releases in this kind of subgenre. So this is Savage Oath with Blood for the King. Enjoy.